Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Errol Yabake. Mike's still out on paternity leave, so this week our special guest co-host is Dr. Jennifer Shuba, author of the soon-to-be-in-your-mailbox 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. Before they talk about her book, Jen and Errol wonder whether Biden can be right and wrong at the same time, why the science says we're basically getting little right and everything wrong on adapting to climate change, and why everything we all thought we knew about demographics is basically just wrong. And, you know, because we can't help ourselves, we also congratulate Mike for officially being above replacement rate. I hope everybody enjoys this. It's a really fun episode. Jen is really, really smart and really great. So let's get right into it. Jen, it's great to see you.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Where are you?
I'm coming to you from Memphis, Tennessee, in the basement of my home in Memphis, Tennessee, where it has been so warm that we had to have the air conditioner on until I was surprised last night with a cold night and we all woke up freezing. But
yeah, no, my wife's on a plane to Tulsa right now and she was like, I need a jacket. I didn't need a jacket in DC today. So it's a little bit, it's been a little bit incongruous, I feel like, this year.
Yep.
I was wondering where you were in your house because you and I have been in some Zoom rooms together. Yes. And you've got this nice like living room set up that's got great depth. I'm sure the Room Raider guys are all over you. But I mean, you got nice wood paneling.
This is the preferred place, but you know, as most people have gone through with the pandemic, there were two of us working from home and the good room kind of got sucked up by my husband because he's a lawyer and I think he kind of yells at people all day. So I stuck him in the basement and I took the upstairs, but he has been recalled back to the office. So they're back and I can kind of move down here to the quieter room where I can get away from the pets a bit more, although there's always someone who sneaks in.
Yeah. For those that couldn't see that, which is everybody listening on the podcast, there was just a cat that came up. It's funny you mentioned your husband and his profession. You know, my wife's a consultant and she also yells at people all day. So it's, and she also has the good spot in the house. So I have been the one going into the office, which is fine. Well, listen, I'm going to give you a quick introduction here and then let's dive into the news, but I'm really grateful that you took the time to do this. You have an incredible story and body of expertise and you've done a really cool thing, which we'll talk about in a second. So Dr. Jennifer Shuba, or Jen, as we know here on the pod, is one of the top global experts in the field of demographic security. So it's demography, but also I like demographic security. Yeah. That's a better term.
Yeah.
One of her many gigs is as a associate professor in the Department of International Studies at Rhodes College.
Yes.
In beautiful Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes.
Though I believe you've been sabbaticaling to finish this amazing book that I've almost finished. Yes. Is that right?
That is right. Yes. I did teach one class last semester, but I am on leave to launch this properly into the world. And we're at such an interesting time historically. I really feel like hopefully a little bit of demographic analysis might help us make some good decisions going forward. That's what I'm aiming for.
I hope so. And I think your book should be required reading for all those people who are trying to, you know, make big decisions. So the book it's called 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. And we're going to talk about it in a bit. And I'm excited to dive into the who, what, where, when, why of this. But as I was reading it, I just was thinking, like, you've probably been writing this for years, and yet it's so crazy relevant to pretty much everything happening in the world today. And that's just goes to show how timely and how important this book is. So thanks for coming on News and Brews for your like global launch. Just kidding. It's not your global launch. Publisher,
yes.
Don't get angry. It's, you know, we're happy that you were one stop of many along the way.
I'm super glad to be here because it's also nice to have a friendly face on the other side of the screen. I'm really grateful to get to work with you over with CSIS and to talk to somebody who I know already coming into this that you have buy into the whole idea of demographics being really powerful. So you're an easy sell. That means we get to have a much more fun conversation about it.
I am an easy sell. And I feel like we've been in so many meetings where we were like, man, we should really have this conversation over an alcoholic beverage.
Yes.
And, you know, it's great to finally do that. So I see that you've got a great glass there. What is in the glass?
Well, I tried really hard to go with the brews to fit with you, but I really wanted a glass of wine after the crazy news day. I think I told you that it has been a long week and didn't realize actually that it was just Tuesday. So I have my standard during the week Trader Joe's Sauvignon Republic. And for anybody out there who loves Trader Joe's, that is a little known secret. It's got the orange label and orange cap on the bottle. There's nobody who doesn't like it. So it's a great during the week Sauvignon Blanc. So
I like people who have during the week Sauvignon Blancs and then the weekend Sauvignon Blancs. We broke in to talk about brews, but I have to mention all the rest of your cool stuff that you do. So in addition to your Rhodes College appointment, you're a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which for those that don't know is the cool kids club in foreign policy. And you're a member of Phi Beta Kappa, which I have no idea what that is, but it sounds super fancy.
Oh, yeah.
Did I just offend like 10 people?
I think what's nice about Phi Beta Kappa is that it continues to remind us as the nation's oldest honor society that the liberal arts are important. And
okay.
I think Phi Beta Kappa will be really proud if anyone ever reads my book from Phi Beta Kappa to see how well informed it is in terms of the liberal arts. We can't forget about science or history or all of these things together. We see that with Russia and Ukraine right now as well. So it's a yay liberal arts.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Yay liberal arts in Greek letters.
Yep.
You're also on the Population Reference Bureau's board, and you maintain affiliations with the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center, which we'll talk about climate change in a little bit. I'm going to draw on your expertise there. You are affiliated with the Rising Powers Initiative at Boston University, and you even have a role at CSIS, which for those that don't know is the Canadian Security Intelligence Service.
Yes.
I'm kidding. Canadians don't come after me. I did get stopped at the border once being like, what is the CSIS thing?
I was like,
it's not that one. It's not that one. You're about the smartest, nicest, and most interesting person I know. So I'm really grateful that you came on.
So kind. Thank you. I have looked forward to this. Glad to be sitting in the basement with the cat and the wine, having this conversation with you.
Well, let's get into the first round. So one of the reasons you need that healthy glass of Sauvignon Blanc is it's been a week and it's only Tuesday. It's especially been a week in Ukraine and especially for Ukrainians. As of the time that we're recording on Tuesday evening, over 2 million Ukrainians have left the country and are now refugees. There was much chatter this week. I'm sure you saw, Jen, about whether and how to establish things called humanitarian corridors, you know, how to get stuff in and ensure safe passage for women and children and other folks that need to be fleeing the conflict. And there seem to be some agreements in principle, sort of like ceasefire-y type things in principle between Russia and Ukraine. The Russians never seem to be able to stop bombing long enough for them to actually be created. And so, as has been the case since February 24th, civilians are quite literally caught in the crossfire. Additionally, President Biden announced today, Tuesday, that the US, the UK, and other allies, this was a big announcement. He announced that they were going to ban all oil imports from Russia, which I would consider a bold, brave, and very risky politically move, given that I don't know how gas prices are in Memphis, but they're pretty darn high here in DC. I don't know if you saw this, but there's already been congressional leaders who are supported and are like on TV cheering the bans against Russian oil and literally almost in the next breath talking about how high gas prices are all Biden's fault.
Yes. Yeah. I did not see that, but the first thing I noticed when the conversation came up about the U.S. banning Russian oil and gas was, it's nice to be outside the Beltway. I will say that, because it gives me a reality check that I would not get if I were back in the Beltway, because the immediate thing people were talking about was the gas prices. I mean, even as the crisis was unfolding, everybody was most concerned about those gas prices. And so I do think it was bold and brave, as you said, but I'm going to underline the risky part when I see how folks are reacting down here in the Southeast.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, gas prices are literally at a record high. I think the average was $4.17. Which is hilarious, because the so-called People's Convoy or whatever is like encircling DC. I can't take credit for this, but somebody was like, you know, freedom ain't free. And somebody else chimed in and they were like, no, it's $5 a gallon. These dudes driving these big trucks. Oh, no. Anyways, so on the oil ban, for his part, Ukrainian President Zelensky, or as Twitter calls him, Churchill in a t-shirt, was all over this and called on everyone to follow suit, knowing full well that the oil money is in part funding Vladimir Putin's campaign of terror. So he was unsurprisingly very supportive of this move. Russia can obviously still sell its oil and gas to China and other countries who continue to play poker with the devil. But, you know, this is one that will inevitably hurt the Russian economy. Potentially even more than the economic sanctions already have, for reasons, political reasons, perhaps, that we talked about. It's not been on the table, but as things get worse, it's like, you know, the option set gets, you know, more and more painful. And I think I saw that Putin, for his part, he yelled at some guy sitting clear across the other side of the room, because he won't sit next to anybody, apparently, about how they needed to stop the flow of natural gas into Russia and just other crazy things. An increasing number of companies are also taking action. Coke, McDonald's, Starbucks, Amazon, Microsoft are cutting ties in various ways with Russia.
That one stands out for me. I don't know. I think we're about the same age. I'm probably a shade older, but I have such memories of the Cold War ending and McDonald's and Coca-Cola going in there. So this really resonates with me, given what I've seen in my life.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was living in Turkey when the Cold War ended, and I remember seeing images of sort of Levi's jeans going in for the first time officially and people getting the Big Mac. And so definitely had that same reaction. Ian Bremmer on Twitter, of course, said, I think he's been waiting to say this for weeks. He said, after the McDonald's announcement, that Russia is officially a no-fry zone, which is just terrible. Look, I think one of the interesting stories that we certainly haven't talked about here on the pod that is developing, and I think we don't know how this is all going to play out, is who actually is fighting in Ukraine. So obviously there's like the Russian troops and the Ukrainian troops, but there's so many other people. So the first time this came on my radar was when we were talking about refugee flows, people leaving Ukraine. There were also people like at the same border trying to get back in. And at the beginning, it was mostly like Ukrainians in Poland, you know, going back to serve their country. And over time that has continued, but there are lots of other people involved in this. So on the Ukrainian side, you have, you know, those expats that are returning, but you also have a growing number of non-Ukrainians. They're Poles, Lithuanians, Danes, other Europeans, but also like Brits and Americans and other veterans of foreign wars. On the Russian side, you've got conscripted Russian troops. It's worth noting that their army is not volunteer. These are conscripted troops, and they've also got private militaries like the Wagner Group. And then it came out this week that they're trying to recruit Syrian fighters, especially those skilled in urban combat. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, foreign fighters is not an area that I know about. I have no expertise in this. But
good. You fit right in on this podcast.
Perfect. But what I will say is that, well, it's good to always, you know, at least I don't have expertise firsthand. How about that?
There you go.
One of the things people say to me all the time, and we'll get to this in a minute when we talk about the book, but is about demographic trends and soldiers. Are there enough boots on the ground? And so I immediately started putting this in that conversation that, wow, I would love to see, and I don't know the data. I'd love to see data on this to the, you know, I'm sure it would be incomplete. It would be terrible, but to what degree can foreign fighters start to sub in when your national population is declining, when the number of military aged males is on the downturn? How can we, what substitutes do we have for that? So I know that'll come up more in myths, but I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. It's sort of given me like a Spanish Civil War vibe, yes, to this whole thing in a way. I mean, that was purely, I think, ideologically driven, sort of against Franco in the 1930s. And this is in part ideology, if you want to call freedom or democracy sort of that ideology, but it's got a obvious humanitarian tinge to it too. So one of the angles of this that I'm watching is that they're sort of far right on both sides. And we talked about in a couple weeks ago that one of the false reasons that Vladimir Putin gave for invading Ukraine was, you know, against Nazis and Nazism or whatever. And he just used all sorts of made up stuff. But what's happened is there's actually people who come from similar persuasions, not only affiliated with his Wagner group or the Wagner group that's associated with Putin, but there are people from the far right in the United States that are flying to Poland and going across the border and signing up. You essentially could have like non-Ukrainian neo-Nazis volunteering to fight on the Ukrainian side versus like Wagner group dudes who also have roots in neo-Nazism, fighting alongside Syrian dudes from Aleppo.
So is Wild. This becoming an American export? I mean, this is not something we want to be known for, but maybe it removes all of that bad stuff from here and sends it somewhere else. I don't know. That is so bizarre.
Yeah,
it's bizarre. It's like this, the story is horrible of everything happening in Ukraine, and then bizarre things keep coming out. And I wonder how much they happen elsewhere, and I just haven't had it come across my radar, or if, how, you know, what's unique about this? I don't know.
I think this is going to be something that we continue to watch. I'm trying to limit my doom scrolling these days for mental health reasons, but I think I'll be clicking on stuff that I see on this because I think it connects quite a few dots for me.
For sure.
Speaking of connecting quite a few dots, last week, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, published a report called Climate Change 2022 Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability, where they connect a lot of dots. And the picture that results, you know, I've got a four-year-old who's doing like paint by number or whatever, and the picture that results is not pretty. Essentially, the report is an assessment of what the science says about how we're doing with this whole climate change thing. And spoiler alert, it's not good. Not good. The gist of the report is that we're behind, that adverse effects of climate change are more negative and widespread than the researchers had expected to find. In other words, climate change is changing the planet faster than we can adapt to those changes. And that's a pretty scary place to be. Thankfully, the New York Times and many other outlets covered the report because even the summary for policymakers, end quote, was 37 pages.
Yes. Yeah.
Turns out, and I mean, you're an academic, I'm sure you can commiserate with this phenomenon, but turns out 270 researchers that collaborated on this from 67 countries, turns out they have a lot to say.
They have a lot to say. I mean, I think this is the report has every day it's on my to-do list to dig into, and then it just carries over to the next day. And I just read news articles about it instead because it, or, you know, other people's slideshows on it because it's a lot.
It's a lot. And it's, you know, they've, they've attempted on the website to like distill it down, but even the distillation is 37 pages. And so you're just like, you know what? It's good enough for the podcast to just like read the report. I'm sure it's fine. So apparently the report says it's not fine. And one of the things that I found really interesting, again, reading the coverage about the report, was that one of the people they interviewed in one of the Times articles essentially said that we've just assumed, okay, like we, maybe not us, but like there has been assumption that if we can't get climate change under control, we'll just adapt. Like technology, like we're humans, we adapt to changes and stuff. And given the findings of the report, there's a, one of the authors is named Hans Otto Pötner, a German marine biologist. And he said that this is certainly a very illusionary approach.
Very German.
Which is a German way of saying you're all freaking crazy.
You're so wrong.
So wrong. But, you know, this has a lot, the report has a lot on adaptation, Jen, and how we're not really good at it, but it also has, it focuses on mitigation, which like, you know, adaptation is like, what are we going to do about the changes? And mitigation is like, how are we going to stop the changes? And mitigation is most commonly defined, as we know, by limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, you know, in when compared to pre-industrial levels. Well, we're already at 1.1 degrees Celsius warming. And so we hear a lot about green solutions, you know, solar and wind energy, bottling cow farts, and the Rastafarian guy on my corner who yells at me about being vegan all the time. And, you know, the potential of organic farming. And it, so are any of those things, given your kind of what you're watching on this, are any of those things going to actually catch us up, you think?
Well, I think a lot of them are some crazy ideas. And I think we're going to start to see some big divides among the environmentalists that are going to hold us back. I mean, that would be my prediction. You know, I've taught environmental politics since graduate school, but at Rhodes since 2008. And it's really interesting to listen to a new crop of students each year and kind of see what they're into and see how, whether they're optimistic or pessimistic. Their knowledge of climate change on average has gone way up over the years. And I think they believe that we will be able to innovate our way out of this issue. One of the craziest stories I saw this week was, it was a list from, it was a Wall Street Journal Future of Everything story, which they have some really interesting stuff. It was a full list of all the ways to kind of geoengineer our way out of this mess about how we can soak up carbon. And it talked about dropping a great big antacid into the ocean, basically. And all I could think about was
like an Alka-Seltzer
tablet. Alka-Seltzer for the ocean. I'm a pool owner. And let me tell you, it is so hard to get your pool chemistry just right. I cannot imagine what it would be like to try to boost the alkalinity of the ocean. And anybody who has a pool down south like we do here would know, you know, dumping things like iron filings in there. I see some splits coming with some environmental justice advocates on one side, thinking about what it does to, like, what kind of, are the fish okay if you dump a bunch of iron filings in there? Should I eat that? I'm not really sure. So what does that do to people's livelihoods and just these knock-on effects? And then a lot of meetings that I've been in with environmentalists, you know, you mentioned Wilson Center. So I'm in on some of those meetings. You see the splits just in the faces on the Zoom screen.
Oh, wow.
So I really worry that that kind of fracturing will actually hold us back even more.
It's like the PETA versus Greenpeace grudge match or something. Yeah. Like, you know, we care about climate. No, we care about fish.
Yeah.
And can't we just figure out a way to care about both? Apparently, according to this report, no.
Yeah, we got it. Once you introduce the technology into it, seems like it would be a great way to draw in some folks on the business side who might want to make a buck. But every action has another reaction, and maybe we're just going to create new problems. And that's the real fear.
Yeah. And I think that's a fear that's borne out in the report. I mean, one of the things that really struck me was it's not just we have been relying on, you know, some sort of future technology, Alka-Seltzer tablet or whatever. We have been also doing things incrementally. Mm-hmm. And as we approach 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, the time for incrementalism is long over. One scholar was talking about how this is really going to require transformational, like new ways of thinking about how we produce food, produce the energy we need, protect the environment at the same time, both the fish and the sun and the, you know, the ozone, and even how we think about building our homes. And so, you know, much was made on this podcast and elsewhere about COP26 in Glasgow. And, you know, that it's worth reminding folks that IPCC is sort of a key convener of that, the COP things that happen every year. And so that was COP26. So this year we'll have COP27, which will be in Egypt. And I don't think it was, I think this was more like news analysis of the report, but there was certainly talk of, especially since this is going to be in Egypt, there was talk of like this idea that developing countries are sort of bearing the brunt of the impact of climate change, despite bearing, you know, very little of the cause. You know, it's rich countries that are putting fossil fuels, burning fossil fuels and you know, adding greenhouse gases to the environment. And yet, you know, what did the developing countries need to adapt to climate change and make up for those damages that they didn't cause and can't avoid? Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to talk my co-host into maybe taking the show on the road to Egypt, and we'll cover it like, you know, CNN style. Yeah, it'd be pretty cool, right?
That would be very cool. I would tune in for that, no doubt. But I'd want to see some Instagram along the way.
Yes, we will certainly. I think it's in Sharm el Sheikh or somewhere like actually fancy and nice. So it would be a hardship post. Yeah, sure. But I'm here for it.
Somebody should fund you to go do that. That's all I have to say.
I like how you think. Because I like how you think, I'd love to talk about your book. So let's get into the main story. Jen, you have written a book called 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. And I don't know that I've ever received an advanced copy of a book like this, not only an advanced copy, but an annotated advanced copy. And so I can't tell you how special I felt when this arrived.
You know, you can never sell that, right? It's never allowed to go anywhere because it's uncorrected proofs. So it's verboten.
When you, in about 3 weeks, when you become the most famous person in the world, I'll be like, look, see? Look
at her typos and mislabeled figures.
I wasn't going to mention them. I wasn't going to say anything.
Hey, but it's amazing to learn things I learned. Man, they print really early drafts. They don't print a late draft. They print early drafts.
Yeah. And this is for people who can't see this. I mean, this is not like a stack of papers. This is like an actual book that was printed, which good on them. That it's easier to review it and read it, you know, this way. But, you know, it's called 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. Why this book? Why now?
I wanted to write a book that would teach us how to read the world. So why now? We rarely hit these big population milestones. So we're about to hit 8 billion, probably 2023, although, you know, maybe something we could talk about in a minute. It could be 2024, but it's looking like 2023 because we're at 7.8 billion right now. So it's 12 or 13 years in between each milestone. And it's momentous. When we hit 8 billion, we will have never had 8 billion people on the planet at the same time before. So it deserves to be marked. And I wanted to be someone to mark that because a lot of the books, almost all of the books that are published on population are alarmist in one way or another. That alarmism sells. So my fear is being a non-alarmist, my book won't sell, but I still think it's valuable to try to contribute to a conversation, to walk us back from a lot of the big myths about population. And I wanted to use the book to teach people how to read the trends. Because if I just tried to say, what are the 8 billion people on the, where are the 8 billion people on the world? What's a snapshot of global population trends? By the time the book actually went to the printer, it would be out of date. Things would already have changed.
Right.
Instead, I wanted to show people how to think about the trends, what kinds of questions to ask about them, how to set them in context, to understand that if it used to be one thing, this is how it got to where it is today, and then how it might be going in the future.
I was going to ask you about how, you know, demographers are, you analyze data, right? Yeah. Like you live in data and spreadsheets and other things, but those data are looking backwards. So how do you take data that's looking backwards and actually use it to think about the future?
Yeah. And so I'm a political demographer. I'm actually a political scientist, PhD in political science, but I have really worked to understand all of the demography behind it. I finished my dissertation while at the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research in Rostock, Germany. And I've tried to stay really plugged into those communities. And I'm so glad that I have, because I think that's what drives a lot of my commentary about population, seeing disagreements among demographers about data, and to understand that every time we see a number, particularly a number that's looking forward, that there are assumptions that go into that. So anytime they're going to run a model and think about numbers in the future, they have to first plug in their assumptions. And so that's, I think, where my political science part comes in, to say, let's open that up. Let's talk about those assumptions and understand that what we're doing today affects where this trend goes in the future. That, you know, myth number one, we could say, is demography is not destiny. What we do now shapes how these trends play out in the future. And we've seen it already happen in the past, and we're seeing it happening right now as different countries have an array of policies regarding fertility, mortality, and migration.
So you've given me an idea. I'm going to, on the fly, create a one-time segment that we're going to call Population Myths and Why They're Wrong. And since I'm the host, and since kind of the whole ethos of this whole podcast is to read headlines and make grand assumptions as to deeper meaning of those headlines, I'm going to give the prevailing wisdom.
Yes.
And you can tell me why it's wrong. So we just started with demography as destiny. And I think that was a great debunking of that. So the second one is population aging is bad. You hear this all the time.
All the time.
Population, you know, countries are getting old and that's bad.
Why is that wrong? We don't even have a vocabulary to talk about it being good. And I'm still struggling to find it. It's called demographic decline. Why is it decline? So if we are individuals and we're getting older, I guess you and I, we're declining. We're seen as having declined since our 20s.
Speak for yourself, Jen.
We're both glasses wearers here. I'm sure maybe our eyeballs have declined some, and, you know, maybe my cholesterol has declined or something.
Amen. But
on the whole, I'm pretty happy with many of the things that have not declined. Like, I low a lot more than I used to, both common sense and, you know, scholarly. So we don't even have a language to talk about population aging as a good thing, because we just borrowed wholesale from individuals. And that's a real shame, because guess what? Just like we are all aging, so are all the countries on the planet. It is now a rare exception to think about countries with really high fertility. We have countries like Thailand and Cuba and Vietnam that have really high median ages. And so aging is spreading all over the world. So we need to rethink what it means for aging. And the reason I would say, let's debunk the myth that it's all bad. How did you get there? People felt really confident that their kids were going to live to adulthood and thought they could have fewer of them. People also made choices about, and this is a little more controversial, but I mean, you and I both have kids, so we obviously think they're great. But there are people who say, I find other things in life fulfilling besides having children. And so I'm going to choose not to do that. So when you think about those individual decisions, they aggregated to give us population aging, but on the whole, it means we're living a long time and we feel pretty secure in those lives. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, my kids are great most of the time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
For my birthday, the only thing I wanted was three nights away in a hotel.
Yeah. The pandemic is rough, man. I've got a trip coming up and it's Friday. It's in and out of Tucson for a book festival, but guess what? Big surprise. There's not a lot of flights between Memphis and Tucson.
Oh, shucks.
I know. So they said, gosh, you're done Sunday, but we can't get you back until Monday night. I said, well, that's okay.
Sorry. Sorry, honey. Okay. Demography is destiny. 1, 2, population aging is bad. 3, immigration is inevitable.
Yep. I think when we say that, we are focused solely on the population. There's so much pressure to migrate. If we do that push-pull theory of migration, those push factors, they are going to, you got the 2-column list. That push factor for that is just, you're running off the paper there. So much pressure. But we know that rarely do people migrate. You know, we're looking at 96%+ of people still live in the country in which they were born. So it's not inevitable because we forget the really important thing, which is politics as the gatekeeper. Yes, the pressure to migrate is going to be there, but just look at what's happening with Ukraine. Even I think even though there's a lot of countries in Europe that are opening the doors, they're opening the doors right now. Yeah. And they're opening the doors for those people. But it immediately makes people think about all the times that they have closed those doors for other people and at other times. And we don't know how long they're going to keep those doors open. So politics, we can't forget about it because it determines that destiny.
Yeah. You mentioned Ukraine. I mean, I was reading something in my moment of weakness. I was doom scrolling and came across something about Afghan refugees who were in Ukraine that were having to flee, and they were actually having quite a hard time fleeing Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Talk about just really getting the short end of the stick there. So, okay. Demography is destiny. Population aging is bad. Immigration is inevitable. Last one. The world is overpopulated. 8 billion sounds like a big number.
That's a lot of people. And it's and counting, second half of the title.
And counting. It's an alarmist title, Jen.
It is. I tried and I'm put just the word kidding. Sex I'm in there. Because it should have been fertility or births. But I thought, you know, if I'm not going to be alarmist, I can at least put the word sex in the title. So
your part one, I think it is entitled Coitus, Quietus, and Exodus, which I thought was just excellent and may actually be the title of this podcast episode.
It's a great idea. Or if we start a band. So either
that's
one.
That's right. Or a law firm.
Oh my God. Oh, now I need to make some t-shirts to go along with the book with comma LLC after that.
Comma LLC. Yes.
So no, the world's not overpopulated. And we've just established all this climate change is happening and the world is ending and we both work in the environmental spheres, but I will still say, no, it's not. Both because I actually don't think that it is overpopulated and because I think it's dangerous to have that rhetoric. So on the rhetoric part, when we say the world is overpopulated, it's not overpopulated with you and me. It's overpopulated with those people over there, no matter what it is. So a lot of Westerners will use the overpopulation rhetoric and they'll say there's too many people in less developed countries. There's too many people in sub-Saharan Africa. And so if we can just deal with overpopulation, then we can solve climate change. We can solve conflict. We can solve a whole host of problems. Obviously, that's wrong because climate change didn't come from those folks, as you've already mentioned. It came from our egregious consumption habits. And when we've had this overpopulation rhetoric in the past, it's led even to coercive policies like forced sterilization in India. So rights can really get constricted when you have that. And it's just not useful.
The one child policy.
Yep.
Which is turning out to be not great for China. I interviewed a couple of weeks ago Parag Khanna and his new book called Move. And the book is ostensibly about migration, but he also talks a lot about demography. And he also, I think, has a similar sort of we're about to peak and then we're going down. Maybe that's not the end of the world and we should think differently about it. Yeah. What's your advice to people who consume alarmist stuff all the time? And, you know, you've done a great service by writing this book. Not everybody's going to read this book, although right. they should. Yeah. You know, what's the message to people out there who are, I think, really easily bought into this idea that there's a lot of people over there and that's bad for me here?
I mean, it's all tough. The only answer to that is to take a really hard look at ourselves. And you see this in the classroom. I mean, it's really the same thing. You can have entire class periods go by where people will talk about environmental issues and how to fix them. And it's all removed from any individual action that we might be taking. And so I think alarmism is really convenient for us. If we don't want to, those, you know, the alarmism about overpopulation is convenient if we don't want to think about how we might have to change some things that we're doing. So you're a Rastafarian on the corner, you know, exhorting you to go vegan. Yeah, he's probably right. But, you know, it's even extra hard to think about going vegan. You've got two little mouths in the house who already barely will eat the Cheetos and the mac and cheese, you know? So
they love cheese.
I don't have any easy solution for people who want to avoid thinking about what to do themselves, because I'm guilty of it also.
Yeah. No, there's certainly like a NIMBY element to all of this. And one of the, as I was reading about the climate change report that we talked about earlier, one of the scholars said, climate is the ultimate injustice. And I think that the way that we talk about climate change and the way that we talk about this sort of, it's someone else's problem, this population or overpopulation as being someone else's problem, is just sort of reinforcing those systemic injustices that exist in the system.
Yeah, that displacement is really powerful. We have our consumption and we are just removed from the effects of it. And so whenever it's talked about, even in the United States, I think there's a divide there as well, because there are a lot of news stories about how poor people, especially in the Southeast, I mean, you see a lot of news stories about poor people in the Southeast, Louisiana coast, et cetera, who feel those direct effects of climate change. But those are not the decision makers. You know, they're not the elite, they're not in the bubbles. And so we just have this displacement that climate change affects all people who are most vulnerable and who have the least power to make any decisions.
How do demographers or political demographers or demographic security experts, how do you think about the impact of climate change on future demographic trends? I feel like we've danced around this, but like, how do you incorporate it? Because you're dealing in projections, you're dealing in, you know, this number means this, and here's all the variables. But like, climate change seems like it's like changing the game whole scale. And is it? And how do you think about climate?
I don't think it is. So, you know, this might be my tendency to be the anti-alarmist, but if we take a long look at the environmental security scholarship, climate change is not the first environmental issue we've ever faced. And if you can get environmentalists to really tell you what they think without the podcast recording, most of them will say they're really tired of talking about climate change, that it hijacked the game. And there was so much other stuff that's now left off. So we know a lot. Well, we know more about environment in general and outcomes like conflict than we realize, because we just keep looking for things like climate change, those exact phrases. Now, in general, though, we don't know that much about the relationship between environment and conflict, for example, because that causal chain is so long. So it's demography suffers from the same issue. We're talking about those underlying baseline scene setting issues that everything else gets built on top of, but it's these distal causes rather than those proximate causes for conflict. So I think if we want to understand what's the relationship between climate change and conflict, I think we should turn back to what do we already know about the environment and conflict. And I appreciate that you gave me the chance a few months ago to explore some of that through a piece for CSIS. You know, what do we know about when environmental pressures cause people to move? And what do we know about migration and conflict? So we've got these literatures we can pull from to try to understand that.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. We will link that piece in the show notes. Jen, I could talk to you all day. And this has been really, really fascinating. I would love to have you back on at some point with Mike, my co-host. He's out on paternity leave right now. And adding to the and counting part of your book.
I believe he is above replacement fertility rate in the household. Yes,
he is. He is. I'm right at 2. So I'm below that 2.1 replacement rate. I read it. I understand what replacement rates are. Thank you so much for doing this. Let's get on to some spicy nuggets. So my spicy nugget this week, I actually didn't come into this episode knowing one, but you said something earlier that sparked this memory of my favorite Onion article ever. Because you were like, man, it's been a long week and it's only Tuesday. So if you Google "It Only Tuesday Onion," there it's possibly the best Onion article ever read. It was written. It was written back in 2007, in Washington, D.C. And it's got great quotes like, "Tuesday, San Diego resident Doris Wagner said, 'How the hell is it still Tuesday?'" And then there's one about, according to suddenly depressed sources, the feeling that this week may in fact last forever was further compounded by the thought of all the work left to be done tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, and if Americans make it that far, possibly even Friday, for Christ's sake. Oh. It's a fantastic article.
Oh, The Onion. I love it. The Onion, I will definitely be looking that up, because what gets me through my endless Tuesday is rewatching old Saturday Night Live episodes. That has been my go-to all year. And I just love getting to look at all the politics of the time. It's about pretty much 10 years ago. I'm at 10 years ago at this point. And, you know, we were just as involved in the doom back then, we thought, as we are now. So I don't know if that gives me hope or makes me more depressed.
I went down a Key and Peele rabbit hole today because some colleagues and I were talking about, they did a sketch on phones on and taking off shoes on airplanes and stuff like that. That is just hysterical. That maybe should have been my spicy nugget, but Only Tuesday has a special place in my heart. But what you got for spicy nuggets?
Oh my gosh. I'm low on my spice, but instead of spices, I've only been looking at the tea, but not the spilling the tea. I've only been reading these articles about drinking tea. It's really lame, but I'm obsessed with this article about Sri Lankan tea, organic tea exports. This is so not spicy.
No, but this is, it's like actually spicy. It's Sri Lankan tea.
I drink a lot of tea. I actually am a tea hoarder. So I buy a lot of tea and in the hopes that I'll be a tea drinker. You know, I'm like, I'm definitely someone who drinks tea. So I buy a lot of tea.
And you know, tea is brewed. And so it's a allow on news and brews.
I could have had some tea.
You could have had some tea.
Another missed opportunity. That's why I have to come back. And then I'll drink, I'll look in the 1200 bags and boxes of tea up there and have that. but I'm fascinated by Sri Lanka trying to go all organic and the economy collapsing, showing that organic is not the way. And I just keep thinking about the, oh boy. What's the left going to say about this? You know, what are my environmentalist students going to say about this?
It's a great article, and it's worth it. It sort of brings into stark relief some of what we were talking about before, with sort of these budding fissures in the environmentalist movement. And it also just makes me think, like, whenever you see that fair trade stuff on packaging, you know, Google it, look into that a little bit more, because it's not always what it seems. I'm a big coffee drinker, and
oh, yeah.
Coffee is a very problematic supply chain.
For sure. And as I learned from that article, the organic market is back to the bubble. People who are making the decisions, that's what we learned from that Sri Lanka piece that's informed policy. The people who are making the decisions are in a bubble where they probably have an array of organic coffees and teas out for them in the morning and think, that's a great idea. And I feed little Susie and Tommy all organic. So we should really help this economy change in that direction without realizing maybe it's not the best financial decision for people who are just kind of subsisting.
Well, we'll link it in the show notes. Dr. Jennifer Shuba, I am so, so grateful that you came on. This was really fun. And I learned a lot, as I do every time I talk to you. So I'm really grateful that you took the time. Hope you stay warm in Memphis. Hope that AC also turns to heat at some point. But until next time, thank you again.
Thank you so much. This was a blast. And I appreciate you actually reading the book. I mean, that's
yes.
an extra benefit here.
I'm going to recommend it to everybody.
Thank you.
And we're going to link it. Is it available? It's available for pre-purchase.
You can pre-order it now, which is a fun surprise, because then it shows up on your doorstep right after that. But thanks to the supply chain, actually today was my original pub date, but due to pandemic supply chain issues, they ended up bumping it.
Well, I actually did pre-order one, because although I am grateful for this, I am also wanting to support the sales figures, if even by one. So we will link to the pre-order in the show notes, and hope that everybody goes out and buys the book. Jen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Earl.
See you next time. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Earl Yabke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. Our guest today was Dr. Jennifer Shuba. This episode was recorded Tuesday, March 8th, 2022 at 8 p.m. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.